Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Eve Ensler. She's the Tony Award-winning playwright, activist, performer, and author of the theatrical phenomenon and Obie Award-winning The Vagina Monologues, which has been published in 48 languages and performed in over 140 countries. Ms. Ensler's plays include Floating Rhoda and The Glue Man, Extraordinary Measures, Necessary Targets, OPC, The Good Body, and Emotional Creature. Her books include Insecure at Last, a political memoir, New York Times bestseller, I Am an Emotional Creature, and her critically acclaimed memoir, In the Body of the World. Eve adapted In the Body of the World into a play that she performed and debuted at the American Repertory Theater, directed by Diane Paulus. In January 2018, she'll be premiering it in New York in the Manhattan Theater Club. Her play, Fruit Trilogy, was performed at the Women of the World Festival in London and the West Yorkshire Playhouse. Her film credits include an HBO film version of her performance of The Vagina Monologues. She also produced the film What I Want My Words to Do to You, a documentary about the writing group she led at the Bedford Hills Correctional Facility for Women, which premiered and won the Freedom of Expression Award at the Sundance Film Festival and premiered nationally on PBS's POV in December 2003. She's the founder of V-Day, the almost 20-year-old global activist movement to end violence against women and girls, which has raised over $100 million for grassroots groups. V-Day led Ms. Ensler to also found 1 Billion Rising, the biggest global mass action campaign to end violence against women in human history in over 200 countries. She writes for The Guardian, Time Magazine, the International Herald Tribune, and many other outlets. She was named one of Newsweek's 150 Women Who Changed the World and The Guardian's 100 Most Influential Women. So, with all that said, thank you so much for all your work, and thank you for being on the program.
Thank you, Derek. I'm thrilled to be here.
So the first question is, can you talk about the organization 1 Billion Rising, and especially the name? What is the significance of the number 1 Billion?
Well, 1 Billion Rising started, this is our fifth year. When we reached the 15th year of V-Day, which is a movement that grew out of the Vagina Monologues and has been working for the last, and it will be 20 years next year, to end violence against women through productions of the Vagina Monologues, which have raised money for community groups around the world and also has launched a lot of programs around the world fighting violence against women. When we got to our 15th year, we had definitely had victories, and we definitely had seen culture change. But guess what? We hadn't ended violence against women. And in some ways, due to the escalated, all the escalated issues surrounding neoliberal capitalism, as well as climate change, as well as wars, we've seen an incredible escalation in violence against women in a lot of places. So we were thinking, okay, we've reached 15 years. How do we really bring this up a notch and make this more serious, more creative, more bold, more daring? And I had just been in Congo. I was in Congo where I had gone back, because we have an amazing program that we support and are in solidarity with there called the City of Joy. And one day the women survivors were dancing, and the women in Congo, I think, have suffered some of the worst atrocities I've seen on the planet, from insane multiple rapes, tortures. And here they were, these incredible women who had been through such violation, dancing in a way. I can't even talk about the energy and the life force that was coming through them. And I suddenly went, oh my God, what if 1 billion women and danced on one day with all the men who loved them, and we began to catalyze that energy and reclaim public space and put our bodies into motion to transform this violent paradigm? And the reason I said 1 billion is for years I have been haunted by that number, because both the UN and the World Health Organization say that 1 out of 3 women will be battered or raped in their lifetime, and that's approximately 1 billion women. I bet that it's more, because a lot of women don't report. But it was this idea that across the world we would see this solidarity. Dancing, for me, is such an affirmation of the life force. It's an affirmation of sexuality. It's about reclaiming public space. It's about being in community. It's feeling safe in community where, you know, in many public places you haven't been safe. And it's also just on a vibratory level, it's really escalating the vibrations on the planet to bring us to a new level of consciousness.
So this the 1 billion has always struck me that the I don't remember the numbers right now, but I recently did the math for how many women are sexually assaulted in the New York metro area every day, and it was like 10,000 per day if you just work out the math for women being sexually assaulted, one out of three, one out of four, whatever, women being sexually assaulted in their lifetimes. And if we presume, you know, various assumptions that if we presume they're only raped once, which is a ridiculous assumption, then it would still be that number. And my point in bringing that all up is that you would think with that number of women being raped every single day, that this would be front page news every single day. Mm. I mean, my point is that 1 billion, you know, we hear very often, and it is a tragedy, a terrible, terrible tragedy, the Holocaust, capital H, and that's 6 million people, 6 million Jews being killed. And this is a billion. This is 160 times that many. This is a Holocaust of a sort.
Well, I always say that it's really, we're addressing this piecemeal, if at all. But in fact, this is the greatest world health issue. There is no greater health issue, psychological issue, political issue facing humanity. And, you know, what we really need is a grand Marshall Plan that would address the scope and look at all the dimensions of violence against women. How do we raise boys? What is patriarchy? What are the systems that keep this in place? What are the long-term impact on women? How do we help women heal? I mean, you could have multiple prongs from a grand Marshall Plan, but the truth of the matter is, not only do we not take this seriously, we have elected a predator as a president who has openly bragged about being a sexual assaulter. He has been accused of sexual harassment a number of times and rape. He is surrounding himself with the likes of Steve Bannon, who we know is a domestic batterer. He affiliates himself with Bill O'Reilly, who's now been charged, you know, five times for sexual harassment. And in his custody battle with his wife in the court papers, she talked about how he dragged her down the stairs. I mean, you don't have to look far in the Trump administration in any direction to see some kind of sexual predator. And it's been, I fear how deeply this has again normalized it in the culture, you know?
I think about that with sports too, that, you know, I like sports a fair amount, and you so often hear about various, you know, quarterbacks or whomever sexually assaulting women, and that seems to be finally getting some enforcement of not doing that a little bit. We've seen in baseball, there's some baseball player right now who is on suspension for domestic violence.
Right.
So there does seem to be a little bit of movement, but it still is not very strong.
Well, part of it is because we do what we do with just about every issue in America. We don't look at root causes, right? We don't really go back to what is at the core of violence against women. And violence is the methodology that keeps patriarchy in its place, right? Without it, there would be no controls over women. There would be no way of terrorizing women. There would be no way of manipulating women. And we have to go back to, why are we living in a world where women need to be kept into their place, right? Like, you know, we have to get to the underlining things. And I think part of this culture is so ruled by a patriarchal mindset that it's very, very difficult to penetrate that mindset.
So what are some of these root causes in your perspective?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, I think it's very clear we're still living in a culture where women are not perceived as subjects of their lives, they're perceived as objects, where they're perceived as resources in the same way that the earth is, right? That you can get from women and take from women, and but they're not seen as equals or entities or life beings of their own separate. And I think, okay, so you begin with that, and then you look at rights, and you look at how women's voices and women's concerns and women's opinions and women, what women do in terms of lack of recognition is still secondary. And women are still secondary citizens in this culture. And when women step forward in any way, it seems to me, with ambition or with intelligence or with, you know, where they're front and center and they're there without relying on a man or depending on a man, but they actually have their own, they're ruthlessly attacked, you know, they're ruthlessly demeaned. And I think, you know, I think until we really look at the fact that we are living in a world where we don't honor women, we don't cherish women, we don't celebrate women, we don't understand that all of us come from women, you know, I mean, that's where we have to go back to. And I think we bring up our boys, sadly, to at a very young age. I mean, I always say I think patriarchy has destroyed men in some ways, in more devastating ways than women, because at least women still get to be attached to our hearts. Boys are brought up and they're taught not to cry, not to show doubt, to man up, not to express their feelings, to pretend they know things when they don't. And what that does is it hardens men and it further and further removes them from their capacity for empathy, from their capacity for connection, so that, you know, as I said in a piece, like hardened tears become bullets, and we create violent, aggressive, detached, discompassionate human beings by the way we're brutalizing men into non-emotional beings.
And so where you use the word patriarchy, can you define patriarchy? And you've pretty much just described much of it, but can you define it and talk about it a little bit more?
Well, I think for me, patriarchy really means where the father is supreme, right? Where the father is the father God, right? Where there's a system in which the rule of man is the order of the day, and where, you know, I was writing a piece yesterday where I was going back to the garden, right, and looking at, you know, the structure of the Garden of Eden, right. You had this offline God, you know, who or as somebody once wrote, an offline landlord, right, who comes down and rules it. He's never part of it. He's never inside the garden. He's above the garden. Right. And, you know, what was the punishment? The punishment is that basically Eve would be a second class citizen and they were given the charge to have dominion over the earth and to tame the earth and to plummet the earth and to pillage the earth and take from the earth in any way they wanted to. And I think that applied very much to women's bodies as well. I think that which is feminine or perceived as feminine has always been perceived as less, as something to be controlled, as sexuality in women has been perceived as very dangerous. Our power to give birth, our power to conceive, our power is perceived as very dangerous. And so I think there are so many mechanisms in place to make sure women never come into even a small inkling of their physical power, their mental power, their political power.
So do you want to talk for a moment about Eve, by which I mean either you or the Eve in the garden?
Well, I've been working on it began as a talk that I did at Bioneers, and it really led to me opening the door to really re-examining the story of Eve and really retelling it. But I think, you know, it's so interesting because I have a very different take on Eve, you know, and I possibly because it's my namesake and it's kind of a very intense name to be burdened with. I mean, she was, after all, the first woman who brought about sin and the downfall of humanity through her curiosity, right? But if you just look at that as a metaphor, that when women have curiosity or when women break out of the domain of men and they actually listen to their instincts and follow their own drive or their own intuition, which I think the snake represents, then they are perceived as dangerous. You know, they are no longer accepted as part of any structure, and so they must be punished and banished. But I think, in fact, Eve, in many ways, was the first whistleblower, that the garden, the father garden was a meme of a garden, was a fake garden, and Eve knew it. And, you know, Gordon, what's his name? I forget his name, but there have been many people who've done a lot of research, for example, on the history of mushrooms. And in 13th century paintings, there are images of the tree in the garden, which was a mushroom tree. And I have this theory that, you know, it was the one tree that God told them they couldn't eat from, because then they would be like God. And I think Eve did eat from the mushroom tree. And I think when she ate from the mushroom tree, she had the memory and she went back to another garden, which was here before that enforced and patriarchal garden. And I think she had the memory, and that memory made her aware that there was no separation between humans and the garden. We were all part of the same organism, and that patriarchy really robbed us of that oneness and separated us so that men could have control over both earth and women.
So what is the relationship between that knowledge and everything you're saying and men's violence against women? Why so much violence? How does that knowledge lead to so much violence? The women's knowledge lead to so much violence on the part of men, by which I'm not blaming women, of course. I'm saying, how does the patriarchy lead to such mass violence against women?
Well, I think, how do you control women? How do you keep women in their place? Is you inflict violence on them. And I think, you know, I think for many men, and I don't say this is true about all men, I think there are many men who don't want to be living in this ongoing state of violent patriarchy. But there's something my friend Tony Porter calls the man box, where you're brought up in a culture of men and you're indoctrinated into that culture. And to step out of that culture, you risk exile. You risk being called, you know, all the negative things that people call you, particularly a girl, right? It's the worst thing anybody on the planet can be called, a girl, which in my mind makes must mean that being a girl is pretty powerful. You risk loss of connection to the community. You risk, you're exiled. So men are brought up and indoctrinated in this culture. And I think when women's bodies become objectified, when they become things, then violence is easy, because you're not treating that body as if it were connected to a human being. You don't know that raping a woman isn't a single act, but it's a lifetime of multiple injuries that you are recovering from on a daily basis, whether it's loss of self-esteem, loss of confidence, a decimation of your sexuality, your inability to trust, your inability to be intimate. We can just go down the list of what assault and rape does to women. But I don't think, I think so often, how can a man rape a woman who is screaming no, no, no? How is that possible? What's going on in a man's mind that would allow him to do that? And my only conjecture is that men don't see women as real human beings. They see them as things to be plundered and sacked and taken for their own use and benefit and desire. And I think, violence is the operative mechanism that keeps that lack of power balance in play.
So how does, let's back up a little bit and talk about V-Day. So you talked a little bit about 1 Billion Rising, which I want to come back to. What was the function of V-Day, and what does V-Day do?
Well, when I started to do the vagina monologues at the very beginning, which was over 20 years ago, everywhere I went, women would line up after the show to talk to me. And at first I thought, oh, this will be really great. I'll hear fantastic stories about their wonderful sex lives and their desires and their dreams and their fantasies. But in fact, what 90% of the women were lining up to tell me after the show, because the show had catalyzed and provoked and unleashed these memories, is they were lining up to tell me how they've been incested and raped and abused and cut and battered. And it was devastating. Like, of course, I knew there was violence against women because I'm a survivor of sexual and physical violence. But I had no idea of the epidemic. I had no idea of the proportions. And I think as I continued to perform, it became overwhelming. And I was actually going to stop doing the show because I felt like a war photographer who witnesses terrible events and doesn't intervene on people's behalf. So finally, I got a group of activists together and I just said, I have this play. How can we use this play to end violence against women? How could it serve local activists and survivors and mothers and daughters and whoever is struggling to find a way out of this terrible nightmare of violence? And, you know, almost 20 years ago, we said we'll do one performance of the Vagina Monologues in New York City. We'll ask really well-known and fabulous actors to perform, and we'll raise money doing it for local groups in New York. And it was this amazing event in New York where 2,500 people came, fantastic actors, you know, from Whoopi Goldberg to Susan Sarandon and Glenn Close. And it kind of blew the roof off the theater. And we really created the structure right there for what would happen in V-Day, because what I was then able to do through my off-Broadway production is I had a wonderful producer who agreed that $5 of every ticket would go towards violence against women programs. So we were able to raise $5 million, which we were then able to direct into local groups and into Beginning V-Day, which became a mechanism for local groups. I gave the play away once a year from, you know, February through March to local groups to perform the play in their communities with local actors, local women, workers, nurses, you know, doctors, whoever wanted to be in the play, and they performed the play in their communities, and whatever money they raised, they gave to their local hotlines, local, you know, anti-violence groups. And it's been an amazing thing to see how activists over 20 years have continued to do the play. Every year there are, you know, this year I think there were 800 places that did thousands of productions, and all that money stays in the community. And it was also a way of educating people about the issues, bringing women in the cast together who could talk about their own experience and bond. And it was a way of bringing the community in through art, which was less polarizing, and it allowed the medicine to be delivered through honey as opposed to banging people on the head, you know?
I live in tiny little Crescent City, California, population, I don't know, 4,000, 5,000, something like that. And this year, and they have many years, they did a production this year for exactly that, to raise money for the local battered women's shelter.
And it's amazing. It's amazing to see people who have been brave enough to bring it into their communities in places like, you know, Indiana or Pakistan, you know, where or Istanbul, where a woman got arrested, or, you know, the first time they did it in Congo, she got arrested. Just to see these brave women who were willing to take the chance to bring the play in, to perform it, to raise consciousness, to really allow women to see that they weren't alone, because there were so many other women telling their stories and breaking the silence.
And, you know, you've talked about the Congo, and you just mentioned Pakistan, and how has your message been received both by women and by the men who are on the wrong side of this in various parts of the world? What has been the positive responses around the world, and what has been the backlash in and how has the backlash differed in different parts of the world?
Well, I always say there's never been a country or city or town we've ever been to that initially welcomes vaginas, you know? You can put Scud missile or plutonium or acid rain on the cover of any newspaper, but put vagina and everybody goes crazy, you know? So I think it really doesn't matter what city or town or country it's gone into. The initial response is always the same. But invariably, women keep going and they keep pressing forward and it changes. And I would say that, you know, some of the more extreme repercussions are that people have been arrested in places. The Cardinal Newman Society, which is a kind of fringe element of the Catholic Church, has been organizing against us for years and creating, you know, scandalous reports about what the vagina, you know, really distorting what it is. But then again, you know, there was a point where Notre Dame, where the show was being done there year after year, finally invited me to speak. And it was like a discourse on the vagina at Notre Dame, which was one of the more astounding things I've ever been a part of. So I've also seen places which were highly resistant through the great courage and determination of women in those places, that they change. And over time, welcome the vagina monologues and understand that it needs to be part of the community. I think the downsides have been that, you know, women have risked slander and risked people saying bad things about them until they know what the play's about. And then they pursue and they literally become really loved in their communities. But I also think what's interesting to watch is men, because when the play happened in New York, it was usually 90% women and a few men that got dragged there by their boyfriends or their, you know, sisters or their husband or their wives. And now I would say I go to productions and it's 50-50. And I think that is real evolution, where men are actually coming because they're interested themselves. And I've had wonderful conversations with young men who have come up to say the play has really helped them, you know more about sex and how to be a good sexual partner, how to help their girlfriends who have been raped. They really learned about it, women to be more sensitive, you know, and those conversations I find very uplifting.
So I didn't really want to ask this because I wanted to save it for a whole nother interview, but I'm wondering if you can talk just a little bit and save enough to do another interview if you'd like, about the City of Joy, because that is always profoundly moving to me.
Yes, well, it's profoundly moving to me too. I would say about 9.5 years ago, I was asked to interview a doctor named Dr. Denis Mukwege from the Congo, who was a gynecologist and an OBGYN, who had been working in Bukavu, which was one of the is a war zone in the Congo, treating women who have been horribly raped and decimated by militias, who are proxy militias for multinationals who are plundering the minerals of the Congo, one in particular, which is coltan, which goes into our cell phones. And those militias would go into towns and villages, and they would rape the women. They would force husbands to rape their daughters and sons to rape their mothers. They would destroy the community, splinter the community. The community would flee, and those militias would take over those towns, which were mining towns, and they would have access to the mines. And this has been going on for over 15 years in the Congo, and we know that close between 6 and 8 million people have died, and hundreds and thousands of women have been horribly raped and tortured. And when I interviewed Dr. Mukwege in New York, I was just so devastated and moved by the work he was doing. And he asked me if Vide would come to support his work in the Congo. And I, of course, agreed. And when I went and I spent weeks listening to the stories of women and doctors and nurses and listening to what atrocities were occurring there, I have to tell you, I was utterly shattered. You know, I've been in other war zones. I've been in Bosnia. I've been in Afghanistan. I've been in Kosovo. I've been in Haiti. But the scale of the atrocities in Congo, the kind of intersections of colonialism and rapacious neoliberal greed, racism, and all of it being enacted on the landscape of women's bodies was so chilling that we in Vide made a real commitment that we were going to do whatever we could to serve the women of Congo. And we spent a long time working with Christine Schuler de Scriver, who is the current director of City of Joy in Vide, Congo. We went with her and we traveled all over Congo asking women what they wanted and asking them to determine what we could do. And what they most wanted was a place that could be theirs, that was owned by them, directed by them, and determined by them, where they could be safe first and foremost, where they could heal and where they could become leaders. And so we embarked on building this place, this amazing place of incredible transformation called City of Joy, where women come, 90 women come for 6 months at a time. They are fed, they are housed, they are loved. They have incredible group therapy where they heal. They are literally working on themselves 8 hours a day in all different respects. They learn about their rights. They learn about agriculture and composting and how to live in a green way. They learn self-defense. They learn skills. They learn nutrition. They have exercises. And over 6 months, they are radically healed and radically transformed. And they go from victims to survivors to leaders. And we've now pretty close to having graduated 1,000 women who have gone back to their communities. We keep in very close touch with them and do very detailed follow-up, where we know that they are now running collectives. They have become leaders in their communities. They have become doctors. They have gone back to school. They are herbalists. And they are true leaders in their communities. And I have to tell you, one of the most exciting things we were able to do is 3 years ago, we bought 350 hectares of land, which is now called V World Farm. And it is a farm that has 9 tilapia ponds and 200 pigs. And it's producing thousands of tons of rice and avocado trees and honeybees. And I have to say, it is employing, 200 Congolese people, many women. And eventually, we hope that it will become a women's collective and it will be run by the women of Congo. And that's what we're developing now. But I have to say, to see the women there growing the food that then goes to City of Joy, and the women of City of Joy go to V World Farm to learn about permaculture, to learn about how to take, the manure of pigs to fertilize the tilapia ponds. It's turning pain to power, and it's turning pain to planting.
So I want to come back to 1 Billion Rising in a moment, but I want to ask a little bit of a personal question, which you can deflect if you'd like. You have traveled the world much, and you have been a tireless advocate, and both of us are long-term activists. And do you, and I know that you're not going to quit, and I'm not going to quit, that's not what I'm getting at, but do you ever get tired? And what gives you the strength then to get back up in the face of both the horrors and also in the face of just, we're both starting to get older and get more tired, and it's not quite so easy as it used to be to hop on a plane. So where do you get the strength, and where do you get the courage?
Well, I think certainly one has reason right now to feel great sorrow and great concern about where this country's headed. And I think the election of Trump, for many of us, and the offerings of those candidates, the kind of lack of a real choice for many of us, was, but then the election of Trump obviously was an incredibly annihilating moment. And I think, we really believe we've moved forward, and then it's revealed to us that we haven't moved forward. But I also believe a couple of things, that we're always living parallel realities. I can hear about the worst news going on in this country and then go to an OBR, a 1 Billion Rising demonstration like we had in Washington last month, where women workers came together in this incredible collaboration to rise for the rights of working women. And 5,000 people showed up, and 5,000 people were there in full resistance and full commitment, an incredible energy. So I think there's always these two worlds going on, the world of people who know that we can no longer continue in a paradigm where 0.1% of the people have all the wealth and are actively, strategically annihilating people of color, immigrants, the earth, women, disabled people, let's go down the list, LGBTQ. And that there are also this incredible number of people who are awake and who every single day are working in their communities to end fracking, to make sure immigrants are protected, to, you know, restore rivers. I mean, we can go down the list. So both of these things are going on simultaneously. What keeps me going are several things. There's a woman at the City of Joy named Jane, who is my inspiration, who was radically raped, then re-raped, then re-re-raped, and lost most of her body, and certainly her vagina was devastated. And she came initially to the first class at City of Joy, and this woman is the most powerful and profound woman, and she is a life force, and she gives, and she's generous, and now she works at City of Joy and is one of our leaders at City of Joy. And I look at her and I think to myself, if she gets up every morning with this vitality and this love and this energy, who am I to complain about anything? That's the first thing. But I have to say, I recently moved out of the city to the woods, and it really is the mother that is giving me my greatest sustenance right now. I look at the miracle of spring, which arrived yesterday, and these budding crocuses and the frogs, which have returned, and these birds, which are just magically waking us up every morning. And I think, you know, there is something to fight for. You know, we have this amazing gift called life. And it doesn't matter if it happens in my lifetime. It matters that we continue our struggle so that the crocuses keep coming up every year, and so that the birds keep singing and the frogs keep croaking, and that our children grow up with this beautiful paradise we've been given. And I also feel like I look at how many young women I've met along this journey who did the vagina monologues, who were transformed by it, who have become activists, who have become social workers, who have become, you know, mad fighters for the earth, and they give me enormous hope because they are our future.
Yeah, thank you for that. And for myself, one of the things that keeps me going is as soon as I start to feel like, oh, you know, this is so discouraging and I'm so tired or whatever, is I think at least I have the option to look away, and things could be much worse. I could be a coal miner in China. Or,
exactly.
I mean, those are the real victims, and they can't turn away.
Yeah, or you could be living in Tondo slums in the Philippines, or you could be, I mean, there's so many worse situations.
Yeah, poor baby, I have to actually write a page today, you know?
Right.
So that helps give me, I'm sorry, go ahead.
And also something we've talked about before, you know, I think people are always saying things like, well, do you really believe anything you do is going to change anything? And do you really believe you can fight off this neoliberal capitalist monster, which has its tentacles and everything? And I don't even think that's the real question. The real question is, who are you if you're not fighting? Who do you become if you give in to this? And I think we're kind of in an existential landscape now where we have to become existential warriors and fight to keep our souls alive, to keep our connection to the other people on this planet alive, to keep our connection to all the living creatures on this planet alive. That's where I continue fighting. I think I realized perhaps this year in my naive, crazy way that we may not end violence against women or the earth in my lifetime. And, you know, I held on to that for as long as I could. But that hasn't stopped my struggle. It hasn't impaired my struggle. I'm fighting for all that comes after, you know. Yesterday, we were talking about the woods across the street, which I'm a steward of. And the man who has lived here for 20 years was just talking about how before me, people had let loggers come and cut down trees. And because they had cut down trees, it changed the structure of the forest so that there's been a lot of loss of trees that didn't need to happen. And I said, well, we have to now devote ourselves to loving that forest back into being. And he said, well, you may not see that for 25 years. And I said, and? The problem is, like, that forest needs to live. It doesn't matter if we're here to see it. You know, that's where we're passing on through our genes, through our DNA, through our love, you know?
Thank you. Let's go back to 1 billion. That's really beautiful. Thank you. Let's go back to 1 billion rising and to the the importance, and one of the things that seems to be running through much of your work is the notion of reconnecting to the body. And so can you talk for a couple minutes about the importance of that, the wrenching away that has happened from our bodies, how that happens, and how we work to reincorporate, and the importance of that?
Well, I think it's safe to say we know that 1 out of 3 women on the planet will be raped or beaten, but we also know there's secondary trauma by being a witness to that violation or knowing it could happen to you at any moment. So I think it's safe to say that all of us on the planet are traumatized in one way or another, but women particularly who have been violated, I know for myself that what you do when you're being raped, what you do when you're being violated is you leave your body because it's way too painful to stay inside it. And your body becomes something that's very far away, something that you don't want to enter because all of your memories and all of your sorrow and all of the abuse lives there. And so as you grow up, you just get further and further away from living inside your essential physical material, but also your body of light too, like, which is your spiritual body, right? And I think what that does for women is it causes diseases. It really makes us sick. It makes us vulnerable to ongoing sexual assault because we're not listening and hearing our body, and we're not listening to our instincts when we get into bad situations. We're not able to listen to our instincts because we don't have any instincts. We live in our heads. We are in many cases, it removes us from nature, because once you're separated from your own body, you become very separated from the body of the world, from the body of land and water and sky that you're a part of, right? And then I think what happens is that you begin to lead a path of some form of destruction, whether you start drinking to numb the pain or doing drugs or opioids, whether you become promiscuous and you allow your body, you know, because you've never been able to say no, because early on in your life, you weren't given that opportunity. You don't know how to say no. And so I think we grow up very, very, very separate from ourselves. And I think for me, my life journey has been a journey about coming back into my body. And I think what are the ways we get back into our body? It's really critical to examine it. But one of the things I've seen from 1 Billion Rising, going back to it, is that dance is a very powerful tool for women to return to their bodies. And I think what we've seen around the world, you know, when we put out that invitation, yes, we did have a huge network after all those years of V-Day, but the invitation was just like, it was unbelievable, the response. You know, in the first year, we had 204 countries that rose and danced. And that's continued year after year. And I think what women feel when they're dancing is they feel connected to their energy, to their sexuality, to their imagination, to their brains begin to function in a whole different way. I mean, when you're not in your body, you're living off a tiny, 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 you're living off fumes, really. And when you come back into your body, you're living off the motor. So I think all the ways we can come back into our bodies, whether it's telling our stories, whether it's yoga, whether it's dance, whether it's beautiful lovemaking, whether it's, you know, finding a partner that will go through with you through a process of meeting your Tara and going slowly till you can move through it to the other side where there's light and connection again. That is the critical work, I think.
So we have about 3 or 4 minutes left, and a couple questions. One is, what is next for you in terms of your own, in terms of your work? And next is, what do you want people to do? 2 questions. What do you want women to do, and what do you want men to do, insofar as stopping men's violence against women?
Well, first of all, I think what people can do is do 1 Billion Rising or V-Day wherever you are. It's very easy to sign up. You go to 1billionrising.org or vday.org. You can contribute to City of Joy. It takes a lot of money to keep it alive and keep it going. I think really every single one of us now has to become a full-time resistor to this regime that's in power. And we have to not allow, we have to remain shocked because it's our only salvation, and we cannot normalize the kind of brutality, murder of this environment, murder of our rights, the desecration of our constitution. I mean, we can go on that this government is doing. We have to protect immigrants. We have to protect non-documented workers. We have to think about our brown and black brothers and sisters and making sure those who are white or with privilege are always in service and finding ways to be in the deepest solidarity. And I think for me, well, I'm working on an amazing thing with you, which I'm very excited about, a book that we've just finished our first draft of, which I'm very excited about. And I'll be performing my new show in New York next January in The Body of the World at Manhattan Theater Club, which is based on my memoir. And I did it last year up at American Repertory Theater, and it was really an incredible journey. And I'm very excited to bring it to New York and then London. And I'm, you know, going to continue working every day of my life to end violence against women and to love this earth and to be in solidarity with every person who is marginalized, oppressed, denigrated, erased, and made to feel like their lives are not and their beings are not beautiful and critical and, and significant.
Well, thank you so much for all that. And thank you for all your work. And thank you for being on the program. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Eve Ensler. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.